Never apologize for talking about a person in a very long time. I could go on listening to this for a very long time. Thank you so much for that nice introduction. Thank you so much for the invitation to be here. And it's an absolute delight to talk about these things, and especially doing it in such a beautiful city. I'm especially grateful for the weather, which has saved me from the risk of overstretching my long day in Madrid by traveling from place to place and see various parts of this beautiful city and just staying indoors all day. And this, I must say, is the highlight to me, to be able to talk about these things, about the world, how we see the world, and what is really going on. You know, people have told me throughout the day that Madrid usually has a clear blue sky and sunny weather, apparently 300 days of sun per year. And I don't believe that, because this is what I see. This is my immediate knowledge about what Madrid is like and what weather is like here. That's my anecdotal perspective. That's what I have if I don't look at things long term, if I don't look at data, if I don't look at statistics to understand what is going on throughout the year in Madrid. And I'll get back to that later in my talk, because I think that kind of perception is really the reason why we have an inaccurate understanding of what is going on in the world. I'm here to try to cheer you up a little bit and talk about why the world is not as bad as it looks. And that might seem like a tough challenge. With the world the way it looks, with all the problems that we're talking about, it's crime, it's terrorism, it's conflicts, it's horror, poverty, famine, new technologies that are wrecking our brain and making us having a shorter attention span by the minute. I just read an article in New York Times outlining the problems with modern technology. It said something like this, that scientists have concluded that American life is moving too fast. Speed is fatal to ideas and real progress and produce quantity, not quality. It is the day of the fleeting vision. Concentration, thoroughness, the quiet reflection that ripens judgment is nowhere to be seen anymore. It used to be so much better before we had these technologies. And now this article, I read it now, but it wasn't published now. It was published in October 1923. Because then we had the gramophone, recorded music, which according to some of the scientists began to ruin our way of experiencing music. And we had the radio, which made us stressed out because now we had information from all sorts of places. And we had the automobile, so people could suddenly take the car and go anywhere. And the young people of America could do that. And they could create their own youth culture where we couldn't supervise them and control that they behave in a good way. So they concluded that it was much better in the past. This article was very interesting to an American writer, Jason Pfeiffer, who concluded that this tells us something about how we perceive our present problems and how we perceive the past. Because if we think that there were some good old days sometime in the past, when was this? Pfeiffer decided to find out. So what he did was that he went to a Donald Trump rally and talked to supporters of Donald Trump and asked them, if you want to make America great again, when was America great? And they had various answers, but there seemed to be some sort of consensus around the 1950s. So then Pfeiffer did something interesting. He talked to the historians of the 1950s about how people in the 1950s perceived the 1950s. Did they think that they lived in the good old days and that now we can relax because now we've managed to control the big problems of our era? And the answer was no. In the 1950s, they said, now we live in a horrible era with so many new problems that didn't exist in the past. We have this consumer-oriented youth culture. They are mindless students who don't care about the lectures. They just want to consume. And we had, of course, the threat of immediate nuclear annihilation. We had crime on the rise. We had racial and political conflicts on the rise. In the 1950s, they said, it was so much better in the 1920s. But in the 1920s, as we just heard, people worried about the culture of the day, technology of the day. They said it was much calmer and better in the 1890s. So then he asked historians of the 1890s, so what was going on then? What were people saying then? They said that now it's really difficult, you know, with the railway and the telegraph and the fierce competition from other places as well. We can't keep up with this pace of life. They even had a disease, a real pandemic in Europe as well at that time called neurasthenia. And neurasthenia was a kind of a mental disease which you had anxiety, you had depression, because you just couldn't keep up with what was going on. When I read about in the encyclopedias of the day, it's headaches, it's back pain, it's impotence, it's chronic diarrhea and other things that are appearing everywhere because of competition and free trade and modern technology and so on. So in the 1890s, they said it was so much better in the 1850s. But in the 1850s, they said it was much better in the founding era, in the 1770s. That was the era when we really did good things. But in the 1770s in the United States, they made a revolution because they thought they lived in the worst era ever, full with oppression and problems. So they longed for the other previous eras. They wanted to go back to some sort of proud era when they experienced freedom and stability. So Jason Pfeiffer and those historians, they went back in time again and again to the next generation. And they said, no, 30 years ago, that was the golden era. Now everything is so much worse. And he kept on going until he ended up in Mesopotamia 5,000 years ago. Because in Mesopotamia, not a long time after they invented the written language, they started to write stories about how we now live in an awful period, full of problems, and the kids, they don't respect their elders anymore, and the politicians are corrupt and the businessmen are ripping us off. There must have been some previous era, some golden era when we lived in harmony with one another and with nature. So in other words, don't trust your feelings. Don't trust your instincts. Don't trust your worry and your nostalgia about the world, because every generation has always felt that. Every generation has talked about how there must have been some previous era that's so much better. And one of the reasons might just be that we're not really looking for a particular era. We're looking for our old, lost childhood. Because once upon a time, the world was filled with adventure, but at the same time secure, because our parents looked after us, and you didn't have to pay the bills. But then you grow older, and you get kids, and then you have to start to worry about the world and everything that could go wrong, because it's now of a serious concern to you and your family. And then after a while, you just can't keep up with all these technologies and things, and the music is not as good as it was when I was young. So that's why I don't know if you try to think in the back of your mind of an era that you think this must have been a great time compared to present problems. I don't know where you end up, but most people I talk to happen to end up in the era when they grew up. So it's not really about the world, it's about something else that we're looking for. It's more existential than about economics and politics, which means that we can't really rely on those feelings. We have to look at data, we have to look at facts, we have to look at trend lines if we're really interested in human well-being and how we can make it better in our world. I'm very concerned with this, and I think about this a lot, because I used to be one of those nostalgics who were romanticizing the past, who thought that now it's so awful. We've got all these big industry, we've got environmental destruction, we're stressed out from all these technologies. There must have been some previous era when we lived in harmony. And I happen to place that in my ancestors, northern Sweden, in the late 19th century. But that was until I started studying history. And when I did that, I understood under which circumstances they really lived. I understood that the pictures of them standing there happy at the harvest in decent clothes, that was the only picture that they could take. In such a year when the harvest was fantastic and they were all well off, they could afford a photographer to take this picture of them in the only decent clothes that they had. And I had to start asking myself, where would I have been if I had been alive back then? And the answer was nowhere. because life expectancy was 30 years. I would have been dead probably. And if not, I would have lived under harsh circumstances and oftentimes when the weather was bad. There was a crop failure and people were starving. So that's why we can't rely on our feelings and we can't rely on anecdotes. We can't rely on the weather today. We have to look at the weather over a longer period than this. And this is really what Progress, the book, is about. Trying to explain in 10 areas of human well-being and experience of the world what it is really like and what it is compared to our past. 200 years ago, but also 20 years ago. Where we've been, where we are, and where we might be heading. And I don't have the time to go through the 10 different reasons here. To get them all, you have to get the book. But I can tell you two reasons, because I think those two reasons sum up the things that have been going on in the world for a remarkable period of mankind's history. And those are the most important economic indicator and the most important health indicator. It's poverty and it's life expectancy, because they summarize so many other things. If we start with poverty, extreme poverty as measured by the World Bank and the United Nations, not being able to consume for more than around $2 a day, adjusted for local prices, adjusted for inflation. When economic historians are trying to project that back into the past, we realize that 200 years ago, 90% of the world population lived in extreme poverty, under desperate circumstances. 9 out of 10 people, which means that in places like Spain and Sweden 200 years ago, had we lived back then, we would have lived in extreme poverty. More than half of people lived in extreme poverty. Those numbers there in our past were much higher then than they are in sub-Saharan Africa today. Because what has happened is we had the Industrial Revolution, we had a growth of productivity so that we could suddenly create much more, we had a more advanced division of labor because of more open trade and innovations that made us more productive. And then suddenly, 200 years later, we have reduced extreme poverty from 90% to 9% around the world. And it has been the fastest in these last 25 years. Because now what we're seeing is the Industrial Revolution on a much larger scale for more people than ever before. If you want a back of the envelope calculation to just measure the size of this globalization thing, just compare it to the Industrial Revolution. What was that? That was some 200 million people in Europe and in North America who doubled their income in around 50 years, a little bit more. Now we've just had 2 billion people do the same thing, doubling their income in slightly more than 10 years, just a bit more than 10 years. So 10 times more people in a fifth of the time. And 10 times 5 is 50. Globalization, as we see it now, is 50 times bigger than the Industrial Revolution when it comes to how it lifts people out of poverty. So it's not strange that it creates some tensions and difficulties and bottlenecks that have to be dealt with, because it is a big thing. And it is the thing that has resulted in extreme poverty being reduced in the last 25 years from 37% to 9%. Even though world population grew by 2 billion people, 1.25 billion people fewer live in extreme poverty today than 25 years ago. Which means that 140,000 people were lifted out of extreme poverty every day that we complained about the world for 25 years. And now it's even faster, so every minute that I talk, another 100 people rise out of extreme poverty. 100 people per minute. That's well spent time, I must say. And then the first thing that happens is that people think, yeah, but what about inequality? Don't we see this increase in inequality around the world? And yeah, we do that in some places, not globally. On the contrary, we've seen less global inequality since the turn of the millennium, for the first time since the Industrial Revolution, because poor countries have grown so fast. But within many countries, inequality has grown. And in some areas, it's because we've made progress. And when we make progress, it's not at exactly the same pace in every place. In China, 30 years ago, it was a much more equal country. But they were equally poor, because 90% of the Chinese lived in extreme poverty. Since they began to open up their economy, they've given people more opportunities to make themselves richer. And then not everybody does it at the same pace. So it happens faster in coastal areas and in cities than in the far rural areas. So inequality has grown, while extreme poverty has declined from 90 to 10% in just 30 years, which is bad if you worry about inequality more than you worry about poverty. I don't. And if we worry about human opportunities and human well-being, the important thing is to hate poverty and not this inequality, because that was just the way to create progress, in a way. What about life expectancy then and health? This is the other measurement that really summarizes a lot of things. It summarizes how we've managed to give people more access to nutrition and food. Chronic undernourishment has declined from 50% 60 years ago to around 10% today. It summarizes what we've done when it comes to security, safety measures, the way we build houses. The risk of dying in a natural disaster is 90% smaller today than it was 100 years ago. It summarizes what we've done when it comes to obviously healthcare, technologies, drugs, antibiotics, and so on. I recently read two stories, health-related stories in the same magazine, that I think sums up in a dramatic way what has happened when it comes to wealth over the last 200 years. The first one was about a guy named George, 10-year-old. The other one was about a guy named Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, it turns out, researchers have concluded, probably died from a sore throat. He probably sang too much and drank too much, and he had some bacteria in his throat, so he died. That's the way you left this world 200 years ago, even if you were the greatest composer, or the king, or the emperor, because we had no way of dealing with that. The other story was about George, 10-year-old. He had something worse than, and now we're back to our era, something worse than a sore throat. He had a brain tumor, but now doctors can do something about it. So they operated on him to remove the tumor, a difficult surgery, so his heart stopped beating during the operation. But they managed to revive him, and they managed to get the tumor out and saved his life, and now he's back to normal, his old normal George. And that's amazing in itself, right? That we can do things like that. But it gets even more amazing if you realize that George is not a human being. George is a goldfish. We give better medical treatment to our pets and our goldfishes today than the kings and the emperors and the composers got 200 years ago. Because inventions, scientists, and entrepreneurs have reduced the price of all this knowledge, all this technology that makes for life-saving devices and everyday quality of life. That's the change that has happened. And that, combined with all these other factors and safe water and indoor plumbing, means that resulted in life expectancy increasing from 31 years in the year 1900, 31 years, to 71 years today, globally. So basically, nothing happened to life expectancy for 100,000 years. And then suddenly, in a bit more than 100 years, it increased from 31 to 71 years. And we are the lucky ones to experience that. We should sort of pat ourselves on the back every day for just being alive. When you say it's great to be here, it's really true in a literal sense, because most people wouldn't have been alive at our age in previous eras. A child born today has a greater chance of reaching his retirement day than kids in all previous generations had of reaching their fifth birthday. That's the extent of this enormous transition. And it keeps on happening. This is why 200 years ago, there was not a single country on the planet where life expectancy was longer than 40 years. Not even the richest places. Today, there's not a single country on the planet where life expectancy is shorter than 40 years, not even the poorest ones. And this is also where globalization comes in a big way. It's not just about money. It's not just that we have more resources so we can spend more resources. It's also that we've reduced the price of all these technologies, all these devices, all that food that we need, the safe water filtering devices and so on. Which means that even a country like Haiti, one of the few places that is not richer today than it was in 1960, even in a place like that, life expectancy has increased since then by 21 years, and child mortality has declined by 3/4. Because of globalization, it's easier than ever to use the ideas, the knowledge, the science, the technology, the devices that others have invented in other places, that it took them generations and billions to develop. They can suddenly use that straight away. This keeps on happening around the world. Life expectancy sometimes faces a backlash in certain regions, certain parts of the population. In a country like the United States, it's just declined by 0.1 year, the last year, because of the opioid epidemic. But overall, and on average, we keep on making this progress. There's always one country leading the pack. After a while, as those inventions and discoveries spread around the world, it keeps on happening in other places. In the country that leads the pack, and it's often New Zealand or Japan, life expectancy has increased by 3 months every year over the last 150 years. And it keeps on happening, and according to the reviews of data, it's not just more years, it's also more healthy years. A review in the medical journal Lancet recently concluded that evidence suggests that people are not just living longer than they did previously, but they are living longer with less disability and fewer functional limitations than they did, even at the same ages all the time. So basically, if you listen to me for an hour, you don't approach death by an hour. I don't take that much of your life from you, only by 45 minutes or something like that. I hope I'm worth that. And it gets better in some places. The countries that are catching up the fastest, the countries that are reducing child mortality the fastest right now around the world. African countries like Rwanda, Ethiopia, Botswana, Kenya, they just, over the last 10 years, increased life expectancy by 10 years, which sounds impossible. It sounds like no one died over 10 years. And that's not really the case. It's about when they're reducing child mortality, every child's life saved gives them an extra 50, 60 years of expected life. But it means that, statistically speaking at least, every Kenyan and every Rwandan could celebrate his birthday, his every birthday, by saying that I did not approach death by a single day in this last year. So why is this? This is the progress that has happened around the world, and it's happening at an increasing pace around the world. Why is it happening? Well, I suggest that this is because of three freedoms. Three freedoms that we often take for granted, but are the pillars that makes this possible. It's about the freedom to explore strange new knowledge about the world, about our bodies, about everything from how the best algorithms to how our world is created in the tiniest particles. To explore all of that, even though it might sound crazy, even though it might challenge traditions or our old ways of doing things. But then we also need the freedom to experiment with this, with new technologies and with new business models, even though it might threaten incumbents, even though it might hurt old companies and old jobs. If we're able to challenge them and experiment with the new things, that creates new solutions that we need. But then third, we also need the freedom to exchange this across borders with other people so that we exchange ideas, technologies, goods and services with other people in other places. That's the only way to create an architecture for solving more problems. And this is the architecture that makes me an optimist. The data that I see about the world, but also the fact that we've created a kind of an open architecture for being lucky. I don't know how we're going to solve mankind's problems. Quite few of them, actually. I really don't know. But I do know that we stand a greater chance of being lucky and solving them if more people are involved in doing that, if more people do have access to the best knowledge, to the accumulated knowledge of mankind, and then are able to do something with this. I've been in the Saharan desert at a village school where a 12-year-old girl, for the first time, have access to electricity, which gave her access to a computer, which gave her access to the internet, so that she can suddenly see that the problems that she's thinking of, others have thought about this before. So that she suddenly has access to all the accumulated knowledge of mankind. And she can add her own ideas and her own creativity to that. And she might be the one who has the next best business model or the solution to global warming. I don't know how, but I do know that our chances are greater if more eyeballs are directed to our problems and more brains are hard at work at trying to solve these problems. So that's why I'm basically an optimist, because we've created this openness over the last 200 years. It didn't happen by accident. It happened because more people got these freedoms, got the freedom to explore, to experiment, and to exchange. The problem right now in our world, because I can't just leave you with such an enthusiastic message. I actually learned that by a magazine editor who told me that we'd like to have an essay from you about the world's progress, but I can't put you on the cover unless you can say that it's really horrible in some way, because we need the horror story to attract readers to our magazine. So can you somehow say that if people don't understand the progress that the world has done, we'll end up in total disaster? Because that's the way the world works. That's the way we work. And I'll get back to that in a few minutes. And there is a risk. And the risk right now in the world is that these freedoms, these three freedoms, are the very ones that are being threatened by the populists from the left and the right, by the authoritarians from the left and the right, who say that precisely these freedoms, this openness, creates tensions, create chaos, creates too much mobility and strange new ideas that ruins our old ways of doing things, our old traditions, our old jobs, our old businesses. So we should just shut it down to protect us. The risk is that that is undermining the very pillars that create progress. And why is it so tempting to do that? Well, I think that one of the reasons is that people don't understand the progress that the world is making. That people think that if everybody gets freedom to do things, they do pretty good things. Then we're happy, we're tolerant, we're open-minded, and we give them freedom. But if we think that people who are free make a mess out of things and destroy things and threaten us, then we want to protect ourselves from them. And then we want to control them, and we want the strong man to protect us. And people think so right now. People think that the world is falling apart. I've noticed. Because one of the first flashes of insight came when I published a chart. I had a graph or several trend lines, which I thought would be the killer chart that would convince people that the world is improving at a rapid pace. So I had a chart that summarized what had happened to extreme poverty over the last 25 years, child mortality over the last 25 years, illiteracy, and chronic undernourishment. And they had all declined by around half, or even much more when it comes to extreme poverty. And then I published this on social media everywhere and leaned back and thinking, my work here is done. Now people will understand what is going on. But one of the first things that happened was that a British woman retweeted me and published this for all her Twitter followers with her own interpretation of the chart, saying, you have to look at this horrible graph because it proves my sense that the world is going to hell in a handcart right now. Because she had read the chart upside down. And she thought that everything that was great 25 years ago had been cut in half in these last 25 years. And that, I think, is the problem with the world right now. people read the charts upside down. They read the graphs upside down. And she's not alone in doing this. One study at the time, this was last year, showed that just 5% of the British thought that the world as a whole was going in the right direction. The Americans, as usual, are more optimistic, so 6% of the Americans thought that the world as a whole was improving. So more Americans think that the moon landing was fake than believe in human progress. That's what we're up against. And one of the reasons why they do this is that they have no idea about these data, about the facts of the world. We know that because when we ask them, they give the wrong answer consistently. If you ask people, Europeans, about, so what happened to poverty over these last 30 years? Was it reduced by half? Did it double? Or did it stay the same? Only 10% of Europeans say accurately that it halved. When actually, it was reduced by more than that, 3/4. Only 10%. More people thought that it had doubled in the era when extreme poverty was reduced more than ever before. And that tells you that something is wrong, dramatically, seriously wrong. And as the professor of international health, Hans Rosling, often puts it, it means that Europeans are worse at understanding the world than chimpanzees. Because if chimpanzees were asked the same question, so what happened to poverty in the last 30 years, and you write down the three answers on three different bananas, the chimpanzee would pick the right banana at least a third of the time. Europeans can't do that. We pick the right banana a tenth of the time. So it tells you that we're not just ignorant about the world. If we were ignorant about what has been going on in the world, we would pick a banana at random. And then we would end up at least correctly with the correct banana a third of the time. We don't. So it means that we must be misinformed, or we must have been listening to outdated information. And what is this information? This woman, the British woman who read the chart upside down, she gave me the answer because I asked her, what made you think that everything that was wonderful 10, 25 years ago has been halved? And she said, I'm not ignorant about the world. I pay close attention to the news. And the news tell me that it's just crime, terrorist attacks, climate change, horrors, war, poverty, famine, everywhere. And every day we get these news. I can sympathize with her. I wake up every morning checking my cell phone thinking that the world is falling apart because that's the news I get. Because that's the shocking thing. That's the dramatic thing that we look at. That's the rain in Spain today. That's the thing that I've noticed right now. It's in front of my eyes. I don't have the time and the patience to think long-term about the last 300 days in Madrid and what the weather was like here at this time. I am only looking at the latest breaking news. And that's always bad. Because shocking things that are newsworthy are bad. If it bleeds, it leads. Bad news are good news in most instances for the media. And that's the way I'm afraid it must be, because that's what we pay attention to. So no one ever read a newspaper story about a headline saying 140,000 people lifted out of extreme poverty since yesterday. That has never made the news. We've never seen a news story about child mortality was reduced by 0.2% since last week, again. But over time, when that happens week after week, day after day, it's the difference between having a life expectancy of 30 years or one of 70%. We never really think about the everyday activities that create more wealth constantly every day when we go to work. But that's the thing that over a century makes the difference between half of the population living in extreme poverty and almost no one living in extreme poverty. So we miss the long-term trends. We miss what has the most effect on our living standards because we're so obsessed with the immediate, the shocking, the dramatic. And I don't want to blame the journalists for doing this because some of them are among my best friends. And they tell me that, yeah, you always say that people want to read the big stories, the long-term stories, and the more cheerful news about the world. But that's not what you're reading. That's not what you're looking at. That's not the link that you're watching. Because we know, we measure everything, and you want the disasters. You want the shocking stories. You want the human interest stories, the anecdotes. You don't want the big stuff. You might want to read about one individual falling into poverty or actually getting out of poverty as well. But one person doing that, that's a real story. But 1 million, who can relate to that? That's just a number. As Joseph Stalin put it in another context, one person killed, that's a tragedy. But 1 million people killed, that's just statistics. And that's a difficulty. We want to read about the shocking things. So it's not the media, it's us. I think it's human nature. I think we're addicted to bad news. I think we're addicted to being frightened by the world because it's in our genetic makeup. I think we're programmed to do this because historically we've lived under desperate circumstances. Remember, until 100 years ago, life expectancy was 30 years around the world. And we've lived in desperate circumstances throughout 100,000 years where bad weather or another tribe or a predator could mean immediate death. Which means that exaggerating risks, being on the constant lookout for threats, was probably of survival value. That was a great thing. It was those who were worried of our hunter-gatherer ancestors who survived and passed their genes onto us, but therefore also their stress hormones onto us. So when we watch the evening news and when we read the newspapers, somewhere in our reptilian brain, we think that any risk, any threat, is an immediate threat to us. It's dangerous. Bad is stronger than good, as the psychologists say. We've seen that in countless experiments. People think more and remember more bad news than good news. We remember more and think more about the episodes when we lost money than when we made money. We think more and remember more when we lost a friend than when we made a new friend. So bad is stronger than good, because historically, anything that was bad killed us. Now, fast forward to 2018. Now we have our hunter-gatherer brain, but we also have global media 24 hours a day. And we have social media. And there are people everywhere who can document anything that happens around the world. Which means that we suddenly see a lot of things that are bad that doesn't threaten our survival. But our reptilian brains think that this is the most important fact that we have to look at. Right now, human problems and tragedies are not new, but the cell phone camera is new. So suddenly there is someone everywhere where things go wrong in the world and can document it in real time and pass it on to us. And that's a good thing. It's a democratization of the media. It helps us to understand what is going on in the world. But unfortunately, it also makes us forget a lot of things that are happening in the world. Because no one knows that we reduce the risk of dying in a natural disaster by 90%. No news story told that story. But we all know that there's lots of horrible natural disasters, because there is always a natural disaster somewhere in the world, and people are dying from it. And then that will top the news cycle everywhere. Homicide rates were halved in many Western European countries over the last 30 years. But no one knows this. On the contrary, every year people say that it's rising because there's always a serial killer on the loose with an axe somewhere in the world. And then that's the most shocking thing, and then that will top the news cycle everywhere. We will see it every day, and therefore we will conclude that this is the everyday experience of most people, being hunted by serial murderers with axes. So I think this distorts our way of looking at the world. Our human nature meeting global and social media. I think social media makes this even more threatening in a way, because once upon a time we got all our information from the evening news, reading the morning newspaper, and at least I did this with a certain understanding that now I will get my 15 minutes of war and terror and famine. And then I could go on with my life and do something else. We knew that now we'll get the most shocking stuff. Now with social media, it's different. and with all news flashes we get. Because now suddenly when I'm on Facebook or other social media, I get nice holiday pictures from my friends. And that's great. And a funny comedy thing from Saturday Night Live. And that's nice. And then suddenly I see children dying in Syria after a bomb raid. And then I read on, and then there's a joke from one of my friends. Someone got a new job, and that's nice. And then suddenly, pictures of people starving in Yemen. So I'm not mentally prepared. I cannot understand what is going on. I cannot put it into a context. I'm just suddenly shocked again and again by bad news. And I can be in the middle of a very nice dinner, and I get the news flashes about another murder, another bomb raid, another Trump tweet or something else that might blow up the world. And so I'm suddenly, constantly, again and again, in shock about the world. And I don't have time to reflect on this. I don't have time to put it into a context. I don't have time to go and look at the statistics about the long-term trends. Perhaps, I mean, Trump tweets might even get a bit more sane by the month, I don't know. But that's not the point. The point is, I don't have time to mentally handle this. I'm just shocked again and again. And I think that's the reason why so many people right now think that the world is going to the dogs. Everything is falling apart because that's the only thing I'm hearing from every source that I am following. And the real risk with this is that, obviously, if we don't understand the progress that is being made, we don't know how to repeat it in a larger scale in more places. But also, if we think that everything is falling apart, that changes our attitudes and it changes our horizon. It becomes shorter and more narrow. Because if I believe in the future, if I think that there are great opportunities ahead, I begin to invest in it mentally, psychologically, financially, and then I also make the world a better place in the longer term. But if I don't, and if I think that there's an immediate threat somewhere, everywhere, everybody's threatening me, then there's another reaction. I get frightened and I panic, and panicked people behave in another way than people who think long term. It triggers a fight or flight instinct. We think that we have to protect ourselves somehow. We have to shut down the borders. We have to shut out the competition from other places. We need protection. We need control. We need just someone. Can someone please clean this up? Because everything is a mess. People who are frightened triggers often more authoritarian, more protectionist attitudes. And they can be afraid of completely different things. It doesn't matter what they're afraid of. Fear in itself makes people less open, less pro-globalization. Researchers have studied this by just asking people political questions. And then one group is being given neutral newspaper articles. But then another group first reads bad stories about bad things happening in society. Could be conflicts between different groups or crime on the rise or something like that. And then suddenly that group who got the bad news, they are suddenly less in favor of free trade. They are suddenly less tolerant when it comes to minorities and gay rights or things like that. They are suddenly more open to repressing free speech or the rule of law if we need that for our protection. And it could be that it doesn't have any relationship at all. One group was being asked, answer these questions about what you think should be done politically. But first, consider the fact that you are mortal and think about when you are going to die. And then suddenly, those who thought about their own death became much more protectionist, authoritarian, and less liberal and pro-globalization than the others. So in a climate where we're constantly shocked by bad news and where we also have populists and some Russian propaganda channels all trying to give us the impression that the Western society is totally degenerate and decadent and it's falling apart, it's collapsing, everybody's losing their jobs and everybody's killing everybody else, then obviously there's this temptation to go for the strong man who promises, I'll build a muscular state who will protect you against everything else. Don't worry, they won't harm you. They won't be able to sell your goods to you or anything like that. I will block this. So this is my problem, and this is why I actually didn't write a book on progress just because I'm happy and sort of relaxed, everything will be fine. I wrote it because progress is not determined. It's based on these freedoms. It's based on human freedoms. It's based on the free market, on the open society, on the globalized world, where people have these opportunities to experiment and to exchange. And if we dismantle that, we won't see much more progress. And now we have this backlash, partly based on the fact that we're not seeing the progress that's being done. We cannot take it for granted. We mustn't take it for granted. That's the risk that we're doing. We think we just take our lifestyle for granted. It's just here. So we can play with these institutions in any way. We can hand the power to any kind of populist or authoritarian who promises to fix all things immediately. But that's the very thing that would shut down the progress that makes this life possible. And that's why I really think that the greatest thing to fear is fear itself. Because fear is politically potent and might have a tremendously destructive effect on our society. Fear risks becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy that blocks all these things that I write about in the books on progress. And that's why I would like to end this with a quote from one of my favorite authors, Douglas Adams of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, who pointed out that the way that we look on the future is not neutral, because the way we look at our future also decides what we are doing now and how we can make it better. As he pointed out, the ideas we have about our future world formulate the way we move forward towards that world. So it's very important that we have a positive view of what the future can be. That way, we're forced to look at where we actually want to go, not at where we're frightened that we might end up. Thank you.